The island of Cuba is currently facing the worst existential crisis that it has ever faced in its history. You've maybe missed what's going on here with all of the other chaotic things going on in the news right now, but over the past 5 years, Cuba has witnessed the most rapid population collapse that any society has experienced so far in the 21st century. At the start of the decade in 2020, Cuba was reported to have had a population of around 11.2 million people. Since then, it's been estimated by independent observers that as many as 2.75 million Cubans have left the island, meaning that nearly one in every four Cubans have probably left the country in only 5 years. An utterly catastrophic emptying out of the island's people. The Cuban government itself officially claims a much lower number of people who have left since 2020, but even their own likely downplayed data claims that 14% of the island's population have left the country over these past 5 years. Even if that official data was true, it would already be the second fastest rate of population decline experienced by any country in the world this decade, only behind the rate experienced in Ukraine, a country that has been actively at war for years and being massively invaded by its neighbor. If the official data is already that bad, the truth is probably much worse and closer to the independent analyses that are being done. The Cuban government now officially claims that the population on the island has shrunk from 11.2 million people in 2020 to around 9.7 million people as of the start of 2026. While the independent analysis conducted by Juan Carlos Alzibu Campos, a leading Cuban demographer, estimates that it's actually probably declined closer to around 8.25 million people instead. One of the biggest things that all of these people have been fleeing from has been a similarly rapidly collapsing economy. Since 2018, the Cuban economy has declined by at least 15%, and that's according to official Cuban government data. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, inflation in the country has absolutely skyrocketed. In 2019, the Cuban peso traded at a value of 20 to 1 to the US dollar, but by November of 2025, it was trading at 450 to 1 to the US dollar at the informal rate instead, implying an annualized inflation rate of around 68% every year for six straight years, which has been verging on hyperinflation and wrecking Cuban savings. The Cuban Observatory for Human Rights, an NGO based abroad in Spain, has recently estimated that an astonishing 89% of the Cuban population now lives in extreme poverty, while 7 out of 10 Cubans are having to skip at least one meal per day. Only 3% are capable of finding the medicine that they require at pharmacies, 12% of the working-age population is presently unemployed, while a whopping 78% of Cubans they surveyed reported that they either wanted to leave the country themselves or knew someone else who did. Wages and the cost of living in Cuba have gotten to a point where life on the island is almost impossible for the vast majority of people. The official average monthly wage in Cuba, based on the government's own data, is just 6,506 pesos a month, which is about the same as just a little over 14 US dollars a month at the informal rate. And yet, a carton of 30 eggs on the island currently costs 2,800 pesos, equivalent to 43% of the average monthly wage. Even a kilo of rice and a kilo of beans, the typical staple diet in Cuba, currently costs the average worker in the country about 3 full days worth of their labor. Gasoline shortages across the island have become chronic and too expensive for most to afford as well. Drivers frequently have to wait weeks now just in order to acquire a rationed allocation of 40 liters or 10.5 gallons of gas that now costs about 46 US dollars, which is usually several times their own typical monthly wage. The highways across the country have emptied out. People in the rural countryside beyond the big cities have gone back to using horse-drawn carriages and carts because of the lack of fuel, while public transportation, even within the big cities, has effectively grinded to a halt. There is also an increasingly chronic electricity and energy shortage that has been suffocating the island as well. Mass blackouts have become routine occurrences since 2020, with no fewer than 5 nationwide blackouts taking place just across 2025. During the blistering heat of the summer, electricity across most of the island will flicker off for at least 4 hours a day now, while some of the lesser populated provinces outside of the major cities can sometimes go up to 20 hours a day without power, affecting everything from air conditioning to fans to refrigerators. Cuba is currently producing about 25% less power than it did just 6 years ago back in 2019, based on research published by Ricardo Torres, a Cuban economist affiliated with the American University, which is why the blackouts sweeping across the island have been increasing in frequency. The big reason why is because the vast majority of Cuba's electricity is generated by oil, with outdated and worn-out Soviet-era diesel generators, while the island's imports of oil have been dwindling and dwindling. Roughly 83% of Cuba's electricity is generated through burning oil at these diesel plants, while 60% of Cuba's oil demand has to be imported from abroad. Historically, until very recently, Venezuela was providing Cuba with the lion's share of its imported oil supply that it needed to keep the lights on. In 2021, Venezuela was providing Cuba with more than 100,000 barrels of oil per day, enough to satisfy about 80% of their domestic needs and more than they actually needed. But as Venezuela's own economic crisis began getting worse, their exports of oil to Cuba declined by nearly three-fourths to only 16,000 barrels of oil per day by 2025. And now, after the U.S. military captured Venezuela's president through a raid in early January, the Trump administration is threatening to sever even this last drip of oil that's coming into the country, too, threatening even more oil shortages and blackouts on the island in the near future. Since capturing Venezuela's president, the Trump administration has been clear in their threats that the communist regime in Cuba could well be next. Within hours of the raid that captured Maduro, Trump and his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, himself the son of Cuban exiles, had this to say.
Well, Cuba is an interesting case. Cuba is, not doing very well right now. That system has not been a very good one for Cuba. The people there have suffered for many, many years. And I think Cuba is going to be something we'll end up talking about, because Cuba is a failing nation right now, very badly failing nation. And we want to help the people. It's very similar in the sense that we want to help the people in Cuba, but we want to also help the people that were forced out of Cuba and living in this country. Do you want to say something about that, Marco, please?
Well, I mean, I just gave you a statement a few minutes ago about, when the president speaks, you should take him seriously. Suffice it to say, Cuba is a disaster. It's run by incompetent, senile men, and in some cases, not senile, but incompetent nonetheless. It has no economy. It's in total collapse. And by the way, they were, all of the guards that helped protect Maduro, this is well known, their whole spy agency, all that were full of Cubans. I mean, they basically, it's amazing. This poor island took over Venezuela in some cases. One of the biggest problems that Venezuelans have is they have to declare independence from Cuba that tried to basically colonize it from a security standpoint. So, yeah, look, if I lived in Havana and I was in the government, I'd be concerned, at least a little bit.
So, Cuba really isn't in a good spot right now. And with an aggressive U.S. government breathing down their neck after the successful Maduro operation in Venezuela, a lot of analysts have started predicting that the communist regime on the island, in power continually for the past 67 years, is now the closest it has ever been to finally collapsing, accomplishing one of the United States' longest-held geopolitical goals for decades. But people have also been predicting the Communist Party's imminent collapse in Cuba for a long, long time now, at least going back to the end of the Cold War when the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 1990s. And yet, it's always somehow managed to endure and hang on despite all of these outside people's expectations. The Communist Party's control of Cuba has made it a thorn in the side of America for generations now, the successive president after president since the Eisenhower administration has never been able to solve. The island is, essentially, one of the final remaining relics of the Cold War that's still left behind in the world today, including its tense relationship with the United States. Cuba is arguably the only true surviving Marxist-Leninist state left over from the Cold War that never collapsed or significantly pivoted its ideology in the same kind of way that other surviving states that claim to be communist today did, like North Korea, which went down the radical path of its own unique Juche nationalist ideology, or China, Vietnam, and Laos, which have all adopted significant economic and free market reforms that have introduced vibrant private businesses that Cuba has still never done and resisted. And all of this is despite the fact that the world's last pure Marxist-Leninist state exists just 90 miles away from the most capitalistic country on Earth, the United States, who has been embargoing all trade with Cuba and sanctioning it for decades. Now, in order for you to understand how Cuba got to what is potentially the brink of collapse today, why the relationship between Cuba and the United States has remained so tense, even this long after the end of the Cold War, and how the orthodox communist regime in Cuba has somehow managed to survive against all of the odds into the present day and defied everybody's previous predictions of collapse, and why this time might actually finally be different, it helps to begin with just a little bit of backstory. Immediately before the Communist Revolution took place in Cuba, the country was ruled by this authoritarian dictator known as Fulgencio Batista, who was genuinely widely unpopular and also backed by the United States because he did America's bidding, often to the detriment of his own people. Batista was a colonel in the Cuban Armed Forces who served as the president of Cuba once between 1940 and 1944, and then ran again for a second term in 1952. When he faced almost certain defeat in that second election, he launched a military coup and seized power through force instead, after which he almost immediately suspended the Cuban constitution and revoked most of the country's civil liberties, including the right for anyone to strike. Then, in order to shore up his shaky and illegitimate position, Batista aligned himself closely to the US government as a foreign benefactor, along with Cuba's own wealthy landowning elites who owned the island's largest sugar plantations, which was Cuba's number one trading commodity for centuries. Batista was also very closely connected to the American mafia, and in exchange for bribes, he basically gave tax-exempt status to mafia-owned casinos, racetracks, brothels, and nightclubs across the country, which was an open secret across Cuban society throughout the later 1950s. Eventually, due to him basically opening up the entire country to the Americans and other foreigners in exchange for blatant personal bribes, it reached a point under his rule where about 70% of all the arable land in the country was owned by foreigners, including most of the island's most valuable asset, its sugar plantations. And perhaps the most infamous example of Batista's personal corruption and openness to bribes while he was dictator, an American telephone conglomerate literally presented him with a golden telephone during a ceremony to thank him for raising the prices of telephone usage within Cuba to ridiculous levels. Batista was openly willing to be personally bribed and enriched in exchange for making his fellow Cubans have to pay more for basic services provided by American companies, enduring him with absolutely zero loyalty from his own people and consistently making him appear to be nothing but a corporate American-backed stooge to most. As his unpopularity grew within Cuba, Batista consistently and increasingly resorted to the military, censorship, and repression to keep the Cuban people's anger under control, even establishing his own secret police force that conducted massive violence, torture, and even public executions. Throughout Batista's dictatorial rule, it's believed that up to 20,000 Cubans were killed, while countless others were jailed or tortured. And throughout all of this, the US government appeared indifferent to the suffering of the Cuban people, so long as they got what they wanted out of Cuba economically. Throughout Batista's rule in Cuba, there was a saying that the US ambassador was the second most powerful man on the island. He effectively controlled the flow of arms to Batista's regime, which he needed in order to repress his own people and defend his position of power. In exchange for increasing the US arms deliveries, the ambassador would demand more generous conditions for US businesses on the island. Batista, along with his backers in Washington, were so repressive and unpopular in Cuba that large segments of the population began turning to the radical revolution being led by Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and their guerrillas as a solution to their plight instead. On the final day of the year in 1958, Castro's revolution was finally successful and Batista fled the country on New Year's Day of 1959 for the Dominican Republic, which at the time was ruled by fellow US-backed right-wing dictator Rafael Trujillo. Along with him, Batista also pillaged most of the Cuban treasury's assets to the tune of as much as $700 million worth of cash and fine art, which immediately kneecapped Castro's incoming revolutionary government that overthrew him. Nonetheless, Castro was dramatically popular with most of the Cuban people at the time, both for having overthrown the oppressive and hated Batista regime and for his own personal charisma and sense of presence. Many of Cuba's old elites who were close to the Batista regime immediately began fleeing the country, especially to South Florida, While Castro himself initially insisted that his revolution was not actually communist in nature, attempting instead to present at least a nominal restoration of democracy in Cuba. Nonetheless, the U.S. government was still intensely worried about what Castro's rise to power in Cuba meant for their lucrative and exploitative business interests on the island. So the Eisenhower administration began preparing the top-secret Bay of Pigs invasion operation to use CIA-trained Cuban exile anti-Castro paramilitaries to invade the island and topple Castro. Ideally, from Washington's perspective, enabling them to claim at least some degree of plausible deniability. A few months after the Bay of Pigs plan began being set into motion, American-owned oil refineries on Cuba refused to accept Castro's demand that they begin processing oil from the Soviet Union, which led to Castro nationalizing and expropriating their assets over the summer of 1960, which led to the U.S. halting their imports of Cuba's sugar, which led to Castro retaliating by nationalizing even more U.S.-owned assets in the country in a spiraling tit-for-tat trade war. After JFK assumed the presidency in early 1961, he inherited the Eisenhower administration's planning for the Bay of Pigs operation, which he decided to ultimately authorize in April of that year, a few months later, and which would quickly prove to be a catastrophic overplaying of Washington's own hand. The day before the roughly 1,000-man-strong force of Cuban exile paramilitaries hit the beach in Cuba, the U.S. Air Force began bombing strategic Cuban airfields in order to weaken their defenses, and Castro finally publicly declared himself a Marxist-Leninist for the first time in response. The next day, the Cuban exile paramilitaries stormed the beaches at the Bay of Pigs. But in order for the whole plan to work, it required the aerial support of the U.S. Air Force, which never ended up materializing after it almost immediately began going very badly for them, undermining Washington's own goal of maintaining plausible deniability. The entire invasion force was either killed or captured, and the hundreds who were taken prisoner were taken to a sports stadium in Havana where they were publicly and flamboyantly interrogated and harangued by Castro himself on live television. All of which simply ended up skyrocketing Castro's popularity in Cuba as a symbol of resistance against American imperialism. All the Bay of Pigs invasion ended up doing was to rapidly speed up Cuba's transformation into a Marxist-Leninist one-party state, and push it directly into the lap of the Soviet Union. Because almost immediately after it, Castro had both the legitimacy and the power to declare the country a socialist state that would no longer hold any open elections. And this, right here, is part of how the Communist Party of Cuba has managed to hang on to power in Cuba for decades longer than nearly every other communist regime was capable of. In countries across Eastern Europe, like East Germany or Poland or Romania, their communist governments were forced upon them by an outside invader, the Soviet Union. By contrast, Cuba's communist revolution was the result of an entirely natural, domestic, homegrown popular revolution that almost immediately gained strong legitimacy after the U.S. government instantly and clumsily began attacking it in order to maintain their privileged and exploitative business interests on the island. Of course, forever since then, relations between Cuba and the United States have remained extremely negative and tense. The U.S. government severed its relations with Cuba the same year as the Bay of Pigs incident in 1961. And then in the following year, the U.S. declared a full and comprehensive trade embargo against Cuba that has blocked virtually all imports and exports between the two nations ever since, with the sole exceptions being on food, medicine, and humanitarian goods. Running continually for the past 64 years now, even for decades after the Cold War ended, it has evolved into the longest-running trade embargo of modern history, and has contributed greatly to the crushing of the Cuban economy. Since the Cold War ended, and starting in 1992, the UN General Assembly has voted no less than 33 consecutive times every single year to adopt a resolution calling for the US to finally end its embargo on Cuba. The U.S., naturally, has simply voted against the resolution every single time, though. During the most recent vote in October of 2025, 165 of the UN member states voted in favor of the resolution, while the U.S., along with key allies like Israel, Ukraine, Argentina, Hungary, Paraguay, and North Macedonia, were the only ones to vote against it. The Cuban government and the UN have officially estimated that over its entire length of more than six decades now, the embargo has inflicted between 130 and 148 billion US dollars in cumulative damage to the island's economy. And it has continually been used as a tool by the US government to try and pressure regime change. In 1963, following all of the drama associated with the Cuban Missile Crisis, the U.S. government also froze all of Cuba's assets in the United States, and outlawed virtually all financial transactions between the two countries as well. Being completely blocked off from the U.S. and its global alliance system, Cuba needed an outside patron in order to survive. And for decades until the end of the Cold War, that outside patron was the Soviet Union, who provided cheap, subsidized oil to Cuba that they could use for fuel and electricity, while Cuba provided the Soviet Union with cheap sugar and a strategic foothold in the Western Hemisphere to project power from only 90 miles away from the U.S. mainland. Castro's Marxist-Leninist regime in Cuba, while authoritarian and undemocratic, was also capable of accomplishing some great things on the island. They were able to rapidly improve the literacy rate in Cuba from only about 68% when they took over to 96% within only a couple of years. They also implemented a state-run universal healthcare system free to all Cuban residents, with well-trained doctors and the highest number of doctors per capita in the entire world, which eventually evolved into an influence engine of the Castros of their own, as they could export their well-trained doctors and medical brigades abroad in exchange for resources they needed like oil, food, and medicine back home that they couldn't get from the United States. At the same time, however, that doesn't mean that there weren't also a lot of people in Cuba who were pissed off at the new system of government. Castro seized and nationalized tens of thousands of small private businesses across the country, effectively outlawed all private businesses and enterprises, and redistributed the large agricultural lands and estates that were owned by the prior wealthy elites and foreigners. Unlike other communist leaders in places like East Germany and North Korea that strictly didn't allow any other citizens to leave, Fidel, from time to time, actually allowed waves of disgruntled Cubans who were angry with his way of governance to leave the island as a sort of blow-off valve to relieve pressure and reduce the internal resistance to his government, filtering out the island's demographics to being mostly loyalists who still remained. In the immediate aftermath of the revolution's success in 1959, an estimated 250,000 Cubans, most of them disgruntled former business owners and landowners who were associated with the former Batista regime, left the island within a few years by 1962, most of them across the Florida Strait to Miami and the South Florida region more broadly. Then, between 1965 and 1973, the U.S. government organized the so-called Freedom Flights between Cuba and Miami, a program that was funded by the United States and authorized by Castro that flew hundreds of chartered flights full of additional Cubans who wanted to migrate to the United States. Over the years that the Freedom Flights ran for, an estimated 300,000 additional Cubans were flown out of the country and into Miami and South Florida, who were all granted expedited pathways to U.S. citizenship after they lived in the country for just a single year. All of this mass migration of Cuban exiles who were disaffected with the communist regime on the island into South Florida permanently altered the region's demographic trajectory to this day. And it's why there can sort of be an argument that there are, in reality, two different Cubas today. The Cuba on the island of Cuba and the new Cuba in South Florida. And there have been many, many additional waves of Cuban migration to South Florida since the 1960s and 70s as well. In 1980, following a downturn in the Cuban economy, thousands of Cubans attempted to gain asylum status by taking refuge on the grounds of the Peruvian embassy in Havana, which led to Fidel announcing that anyone who wanted to leave the country could do so freely. The Cuban-American community in South Florida then assembled a hastily put-together flotilla and began ferrying thousands of Cubans to America from the island's Mariel Harbor, which gave this particular exodus its name, the Mariel Boatlift. Fidel is also known to have opened up his prisons and mental institutions during this specific exodus and sent thousands of prisoners and patients he didn't want along with the rest, who were all taken into South Florida by the Boatlift, along with thousands of others who wanted to leave for economic or political reasons. Within a few months, another 125,000 more Cubans were transported to the Miami area before the U.S. and Cuban governments mutually agreed to put a stop to it. All of this history of Cuban migration into South Florida has since made it the most Cuban area in the world anywhere outside of the island of Cuba itself. Today, roughly 2 million people in the Miami metropolitan area are of Cuban ancestry. They're the largest single ethnic group present in the Miami area now, and they make up about a third of Miami's total population. When you consider that Havana itself has an estimated metropolitan population of around 2.15 million people now, the Cuban population in Miami is actually about the same size. And since Miami's Cuban population is growing faster than Havana's is, it's conceivable soon that Miami will actually become the largest Cuban city in the world. When you further consider this more recent population exodus from Cuba that's been happening since 2020, South Florida, as a broad region, now has about a quarter of the same Cuban population as the island of Cuba itself has. Which is why I said earlier that South Florida has basically become a second Cuba. And it's through this lens that I would argue that the Cubans are one of the world's peoples that were also divided along ideological and political lines during the Cold War, like the Germans, Koreans, and Vietnamese all were as well. And just like those other peoples, the Cubans became divided between a hyper-communist system on the island of Cuba and a hyper-capitalist system in their enclave in South Florida. One of Miami's nicknames today is the capital of Latin America, and there's a lot of good points of evidence to back that claim up. Because of the large Cuban population in Miami and other Latino groups, around 70% of the city's population speaks Spanish as their primary language, which makes Miami the only one of America's top 10 largest metropolitan areas that is both majority Spanish-speaking and ethnically Latino. Miami also has, by far, the largest GDP and economy of any majority Spanish-speaking city in the world today, giving it the legitimate authority to claim the title as the Spanish-speaking world's most economically valuable city. Miami, all on its own, currently has more than double the GDP of the entire island of Cuba combined, and it's arguably becoming the most capitalistic city not just in Latin America, but even in the United States. Since 2020, the Miami area has gained another nickname, Wall Street South, because of all of the New York City-based financial companies and institutions that have relocated or shifted their operations there due to the lower taxes and more business-friendly environment. It's been estimated that more than $1 trillion worth of assets have been shifted from New York City to Miami just since 2020, including the headquarter relocations of more than 50 major investment firms. And a big part of why that's been happening is the foundation of Miami as a bastion of exiles from Cuba, who happen to be the most capitalistic-minded Cubans who left the communist system on the island over generations and made Miami, basically, the capitalist alternative to the island of Cuba in the same way that West Germany was to East Germany, or South Korea still is to North Korea. When the Soviet Union suddenly collapsed in 1991, the communist regime in Cuba lost their historical benefactor and supporter and entered into what the government has called the special period throughout the 1990s. In a flash, Cuba lost all of their Soviet-era subsidies and privileged oil imports that had been propping up the economy for decades, which led to their imports and exports crashing by more than 80% and their economy losing about a third of its value over just a couple of years by 1993. Then, as now, there was a lot of speculation that this was inevitably going to become the end of communism on the island. In 1994, in the midst of this crisis over a period of 5 weeks during particularly intense rioting in Cuba, Fidel once again announced that anybody who wanted to leave the country could do so freely without hindrance, which triggered another mass exodus of around 35,000 Cubans who assembled makeshift rafts and attempted to float over the Florida Strait to America. This exodus ultimately became a sort of turning point in America's relationship with Cuban exiles and refugees. Struggling to deal with the political consequences of this particular exodus, the Clinton administration reformed America's migration policy regarding Cuba through the new wet feet, dry feet policy, which set it so that Cubans caught in the waters by the Coast Guard between the two countries would be summarily returned back to Cuba or sent to a third country, while Cubans who made it to the shore on land in the U.S. would receive a chance to stay in the U.S. and pursue permanent residency and citizenship following a year's time. Conflict between the Cuban and U.S. governments reached a new high point throughout the 1990s as well, where the Cold War effectively never ended like it did in most other parts of the world. In 1996, an organization made up of Cuban-American exiles in South Florida called Brothers to the Rescue were using small private Cessna aircraft to take flights over Cuba to drop anti-Castro propaganda leaflets across the island. In February of that year, a Cuban Air Force MiG-29 fighter aircraft shot down two unarmed Cessnas that were taking part in one of these operations, killing all four of the Cuban-American exile participants who were on board, and sharply spiking tensions in the process. Then the next year, in 1997, an anti-communist militia of Cuban-American exiles based in South Florida organized a series of bombing attacks against various hotels in Havana in an attempt to undermine Cuba's resurgent tourism industry. One foreign tourist from Italy was killed in the bombings, and 11 others were wounded. A man named Luis Posada Carriles later admitted to having organized the bombings, a Cuban-American exile and former CIA officer. Posada had also previously helped organize the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961, and was widely considered to have been responsible for the bombing of a Cuban commercial airliner back in 1976 that had killed 73 people on board. And he was later briefly jailed in Panama in 2000 for allegedly plotting an assassination attempt on Castro. In 2005, Posada entered the U.S. under a false passport and was granted political asylum status, which further strained tensions as the Cuban government consistently requested his extradition to stand trial in Cuba, which the U.S. consistently rejected until Posada died peacefully in old age at 90 years old in 2018. And then, in 1998, five Cuban intelligence officers were arrested by American authorities in Miami on charges of espionage, who later became known as the Cuban Five. After consistently denying that the captured men were intelligence agents, the Cuban government finally acknowledged them 3 years later in 2001, claiming that they were only spying on the Cuban-American exile community in South Florida rather than on the U.S. government itself. Most of the men would be held in prison for the next decade and a half, until the Obama administration later negotiated a prisoner exchange for them with the Cuban government. And all the while, the U.S. trade embargo on Cuba continued, as Cuba floundered around trying to find new trade partners to replace the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc with. Near the end of the decade in 1998, the communist regime in Cuba finally gained a new lifeline after Hugo Chavez and his Socialist Party won the presidential election in Venezuela. Quickly stepping up to largely fill in the gap that was left behind by the Soviets, Chavez's administration in Venezuela began supplying Cuba with a new source of heavily subsidized oil again, in exchange for thousands of doctors with Cuba's well-trained medical brigades, along with their intelligence and security services, both to help spy on their own people and to guard their leadership. At the peak of this cooperation between the two countries between 2008 and 2015, Venezuela was supplying Cuba with approximately 100,000 barrels of subsidized oil per day that met more than half of Cuba's oil import needs and underpinned Cuba's faltering electricity generation and industrial output, while nearly 30,000 well-trained Cuban doctors and medical technicians served in Venezuela. Cuba also gained the capability to resell the subsidized oil that they were receiving from Venezuela to China for higher prices than what they had paid for it, which gave them a rare avenue to acquire hard foreign currency in defiance of the U.S. financial and trade sanctions that were still placed upon them. And meanwhile, tensions between Cuba and the United States remained locked in the old Cold War mentality throughout the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations, until, for a brief moment, things looked like they might finally begin changing after decades during the later years of the Obama administration. In December of 2014, Obama and Communist Cuba's second president, Raul Castro, Fidel's younger brother who had taken over in 2006 after Fidel grew ill, shocked the world with a dual announcement on television that Cuba and the United States would be fully restoring diplomatic ties again for the first time since the 1960s. While all of his predecessors had demanded immediate political and economic concessions from the Communist Party of Cuba in exchange for a normalization of ties, which were always refused, Obama was the first U.S. president who calculated instead that immediately establishing closer economic, cultural, and political ties with Cuba, even without any upfront concessions from the Communist Party, would gradually result in a moderation of the Communist Party's platform over the long haul anyway. Almost immediately after their joint address, both countries reopened their embassies for the first time in 53 years. A few months later, in 2015, Obama removed Cuba from America's State Sponsors of Terrorism list. And in 2016, he loosened up U.S. restrictions on Americans' ability to travel to Cuba, enabling U.S. airlines to resume regular air service to the island and for U.S. cruise ships to port in Cuban harbors, which all opened up a massive surge in U.S. tourism to Cuba again, and a big new source of foreign currency for both the government and small local entrepreneurs like taxi drivers and restaurateurs who began catering to them. In just a single year in 2015, because of all of this, Cuba's economy grew by more than 4%. And it was a boon for U.S. businesses as well. For a couple of years, Cuba was one of Airbnb's fastest-growing markets, while executives from Marriott and PayPal accompanied Obama's personal visit to Cuba in March of 2016, when he became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the island in 88 years. Obama's opening up to Cuba was massively popular with both Cubans and the broader American public. But as it would turn out, this new policy would only end up lasting for a couple of years, because the successor to the U.S. presidency, Donald Trump, would effectively end and reverse everything. For Trump, railing against Obama's friendly policies towards Cuba and promising to reverse them was a campaign tactic to appeal to conservative Cuban-American voters in South Florida, a demographic long opposed to the continuation of communist rule in their ancestral homeland, both for ideological reasons and also because much of their or their ancestors' property had been expropriated and seized following the revolution that they wanted to be fairly compensated for. Many high-profile Cuban-American politicians, like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, were staunchly opposed to the Obama administration's policies of openness with the regime in Cuba without demanding any major political concessions from them. And Trump's strategy of attempting to appeal to their demographic in the 2016 election ultimately proved to be highly successful for him, as 54% of the Cuban-American voters in Florida chose him, compared to only 41% who voted for Hillary Clinton. This ended up proving to be politically decisive for Trump in Florida, and likely handed him the entire nationwide election. Florida just barely voted more for Trump than Hillary in 2016, with 49% of the state's overall vote to Trump and 47.8% to Hillary. Trump only won in Florida by a little more than 112,000 votes, out of more than 9 million total votes cast. Nationwide, Latinos overwhelmingly voted in favor for Hillary, with 71% of their total, compared to just 28% who voted for Trump. Cuban Americans in Florida, however, were one of the very few Latino demographics in the country that voted significantly more in favor of Trump during the election instead. And had they voted more in line with the broader Latino community nationwide, their vote would have shifted from plus 73,442 in favor of Trump to plus 242,921 in favor of Clinton, which in other words would have been enough to have shifted the entire state and all of its 29 electoral votes over to Clinton, which would have handed the entire general election and the presidency to Clinton instead. So basically, the Cuban-American support for Trump in Florida effectively handed him the presidency in 2016. And Trump rewarded them for their loyalty by immediately doing what he promised them when he entered into office in 2017, adopting a renewed hardline approach to the communist regime in Cuba with the ultimate goal of full-on regime change, and reversing all of Obama's policies that had attempted to open up and normalize relations with the Castros still being in charge. Trump immediately began restricting the ability for Americans to travel to Cuba again, and he eventually placed a cap on the amount of remittances that U.S. citizens were able to send to Cuban nationals. Before Trump's cap, Cuban Americans could essentially send however much they wanted to their relatives on the island, but Trump capped the maximum limit to just $1,000 per person per quarter, or $4,000 per year instead, sharply reducing the amount of cash inflows that were coming to the island. Later in 2017, multiple staff members at the U.S. Embassy in Havana began reporting mysterious neurological symptoms and illnesses that later became known simply as Havana Syndrome. No cause for Havana Syndrome has ever been publicly confirmed, but the U.S. government has suspected the Cuban government of being involved, and after the reports started happening, the State Department severely reduced their staff at the embassy in Havana and expelled most of the Cuban staff from the Cuban embassy in Washington, which essentially brought visa processing between them to a screeching halt. By 2019, American visitors to Cuba were blocked from staying in most hotels in the country. Most air and cruise travel between the countries was halted again, Western Union was pressured into ending their wiring services to the island, and the Trump administration was already attempting to interrupt Venezuela's oil shipments to Cuba through targeted sanctions on the carriers that were transporting the oil. In the final days of the first Trump administration, right before Biden took over office, the Trump administration also re-added Cuba back to the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism again, the most severe consequence of which was wrecking Cuba's ability to participate in the international financial structures that are dominated by the United States. All of these renewed American sanctions on Cuba, plus the crippling trade embargo that had continually been in place since the 1960s, inflicted billions of dollars worth of damage on the Cuban economy, with the explicit purpose of attempting to encourage either regime change or regime moderation on the island. And at the same time, the COVID-19 pandemic wrecked whatever was left of Cuba's tourism industry just after it had started growing again during the Obama administration. Foreign tourists to the island plummeted from millions in 2018 and 19 to virtually nobody across 2020 and 21, costing the country billions of additional dollars in lost tourism revenue. And as Cuban-American families stopped visiting because of the new restrictions and the pandemic, the value of their remittances also collapsed from $3.7 billion in 2019 down to just $1.1 billion in 2021. And on top of all of these externally induced problems, the Cuban economy itself was still saddled with the inefficient structural problems that are associated with most centrally planned economies as well. Food production in Cuba completely collapsed during this time period, both due to a lack of cash for farm equipment and fertilizer, but also because of inefficient government-set price controls on produce that left Cuban farmers with no real incentive to actually work and produce. The Cuban armed forces themselves are also known to control a sprawling conglomerate in the country that's best known by its acronym, GESA, which, according to reporting by the Miami Herald, currently controls at least 40% of the Cuban economy and $18 billion worth of secretive, stashed-away assets that have been hidden from the Cuban public. GESA controls most of Cuba's hotels, gas stations, supermarkets, and the whole currency exchange business, which are all of the most profitable industries on the island. The Communist Party of Cuba has long blamed all of the island's problems on the U.S. government and the trade embargo, and yet, reporting by the Miami Herald on GESA's secretive operations and assets has revealed that they have plenty of cash on hand to cover all of Cuba's most vital expenses, including the $43 million that's required per year to cover access to the 63 priority medications that have been limited in Cuba, and the $250 million per year that's required to operate and maintain Cuba's electricity grid. They simply don't, and have continued hoarding the limited assets that are available in Cuba for themselves, to the detriment of everybody else who's not closely connected to the Communist Party itself. In the 5 years up to 2023, Cuba's once vaunted sugar industry collapsed by 68%, its fishing industry by 53%, its broader agricultural industry by 52%, and its manufacturing industry by 41%. On top of the near total collapse in the tourism industry, which GESA had misallocated most of their investment capital into over more pressing industries that could have benefited the Cuban people more, like agriculture and medicine. All of this, near the end of Trump's first term, was the beginning of Cuba's current existential crisis, as the lack of foreign earnings led to a collapse in the government's ability to provide most basic services. Biden then ran on a campaign criticizing how Trump's policies had negatively affected Cuban families, and promised to revert back to the Obama era of normalization again. But then, after he assumed the presidency in 2021, he basically just didn't do anything for years that kept nearly all of Trump's maximum pressure policies on the island still in place. Wary of the outsized political influence of the Cuban-American exile community in South Florida that has always favored a tough foreign policy approach to Cuba, Biden remained fearful throughout his presidency of doing anything much different than Trump, lest he upset them and risk losing Florida again in the 2024 election. Biden eliminated Trump's restrictions on the amount of remittances that could be sent to Cuba and some of the travel restrictions for U.S. citizens. But he also maintained the first Trump administration's designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism. which continued ensnaring Cuba's ability to access the global financial system. It wasn't until Biden was imminently about to leave the presidency on the 14th of January, 2025, that he finally decided to remove Cuba from the list. But it was too little, too late. Just 6 days after Biden did so, Trump returned back to office for a second term and immediately re-added Cuba back to the list the very day he assumed office. With virtually all of the Trump-era restrictions on Cuba remaining in place throughout the Biden era and the COVID-19 pandemic wrecking the island's nascent tourism industry, Cuba was also stricken by the crippling economic crisis in Venezuela, which resulted in the Venezuelans sending less and less of their subsidized oil to Cuba's way. Remember that as recently as 2021, the Venezuelans were still sending Cuba approximately 100,000 barrels of oil per day. But by 2024, the final year of the Biden presidency, they were only sending Cuba about 32,000 barrels of oil per day instead. And by 2025, it had declined even further to just 16,000 barrels per day, which exacerbated Cuba's shortage of foreign exchange currency and contributed to the increasing pace of fuel shortages and electricity blackouts across the island, as they struggled to find replacements willing to trade with them in the face of the U.S. economic and trade embargo and sanctions regime. Struggling to cope with the scale of all of these crises striking the island at the same time that were triggering blackouts and shortages of basic food and medicine, large-scale anti-regime protests erupted across Cuba over the summer of 2021 that were met by the Communist Party with harsh repression. Hundreds of protesters were arrested, and at least 710 of them were later charged with crimes, including serious charges like sedition that carried lengthy prison sentences of up to 30 years behind bars. The scale of the crisis, the biggest since the collapse of the Soviet Union for the island, and the Cuban government's own repression and crushing of dissent is what led to the unprecedented exodus of people away from Cuba across the 2020s. In 2020, Nicaragua significantly loosened visa restrictions for Cuban nationals, which led to Cubans by the hundreds of thousands taking flights to Nicaragua and then traveling by land north towards the U.S. southern border and entering throughout the Biden administration. The latest episode in the Cuban government's apparent willingness to export its dissenters away from the country. Throughout Biden's presidency, an estimated 850,000 Cubans entered into the United States. And then came the return of Trump again in 2025, and the return back to his even stricter policies on Cuba. Trump's hand-picked Secretary of State is Marco Rubio, the son of Cuban exiles who is the product of South Florida's Cuban-American exile community. He has been a lifetime hawk on America's policy towards the communist regime in Cuba, and his ultimate geopolitical project has been the toppling of the Communist Party from power in Cuba once and for all. As Secretary of State, he is now the highest-ranking U.S. government official of Cuban ancestry in the country's history. And while simultaneously serving as Trump's national security advisor, he is arguably the most powerful Secretary of State in American history since Henry Kissinger. He is incredibly influential in the second Trump administration, and the primary force that's driving the administration's policy towards Cuba, and showing even more support than they did for Trump in the previous elections in 2016 and in 2020, Cuban Americans in Florida voted even more overwhelmingly in favor of Trump again in 2024, despite Biden's best attempts to appease them, with 68% of their total voting Trump, an even higher ratio than white men who voted for Trump in 2024. All of which has given the Trump administration the full legitimacy to finally attempt and accomplish the capitalist Cuba's decades-long dream of toppling the communists from power in the island of Cuba. With a military operation that ousted Maduro from Venezuela, one of Trump and Rubio's goals has been to eliminate the remaining trickle of oil that was still flowing into Cuba from the country, which will probably plunge the island into an even greater electricity and fuel crisis than it was suffering before, with other countries like Mexico and Russia unlikely to step in and fill the gap because of political pressure from the United States. The pressure on Cuba is therefore still building, but it's unclear whether or not it'll be enough to truly crack it. While it's also unclear if the pressure could become too great and cause a catastrophic state collapse scenario like over in Haiti. Cuba is unlike Venezuela in the sense that the Communist Party has maintained its grip on power in the island for nearly 7 decades now, It managed to survive the retirement and death of Fidel Castro when power passed to his younger brother, Raul. And it managed to survive when Raul passed the presidency to a handpicked successor in 2018, Miguel Díaz-Canel, who remains Cuba's current leader and the first non-Castro head of state since the late 1950s. Nonetheless, Raul Castro is still alive for the time being and maintains a significant level of control, influence, and power behind the scenes. At the elderly age of 94 years old, however, his remaining time in our world is likely not much longer, and a potential succession crisis behind the scenes in the Communist Party looms once he's gone. It remains unclear how, and if, communism can continue surviving in Cuba without the leadership of the first generation of Castros still continuing it. For the moment, the Trump administration seems unwilling to use military force in Cuba to encourage regime change the same way they have done so in Venezuela, and the same way they have threatened to do in Iran. There is probably a high degree of fear of applying too much pressure on Cuba right now and causing it to completely collapse in a Haiti-style scenario, which would skyrocket rates of Cuban migration to the United States even further than it's already been these past few years, which would greatly complicate the Trump administration's domestic migration agenda and policy. What's most likely to continue happening between the U.S. and Cuba instead is a continuation of the decades-long trade embargo and financial sanctions choking Cuba's ability to trade, a continuation of severing Cuba's few remaining sources of oil imports to further cripple the island's electricity and fuel supplies, and a holding out for hope in Washington that the Communist Party will eventually agree to become pragmatic and negotiate with the U.S. on moderating their economic policies and their political authoritarianism, and in so doing, allowing more private businesses access to U.S. companies, restoring some of the value of expropriated assets and property over the decades to the Cuban-American community in South Florida and to U.S. businesses, and releasing some political prisoners in exchange for America's loosening up of the sanctions, the oil restrictions, and the embargo terms. The Communist Party of Cuba is currently in the most dire crisis that it's probably ever been in. And while it might end up finally collapsing or relenting to America's pressure under the weight of this crisis, like many people have been predicting, it also might continue defying everybody's expectations and continue on existing regardless, just as it somehow managed to do so far. In a way, sort of like North Korea. Just like what happened to Cuba in the 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed and lost their primary supporter, North Korea went through the same thing that resulted in a deluge of expert analysis that predicted it would result in the country's imminent collapse. And yet, North Korea somehow kept on surviving just like Cuba did anyway. But if you thought that Cuba's experiences have been catastrophic in the aftermath of the Cold War, and they have been, North Korea's experience in the 1990s after losing the Soviet Union was downright apocalyptic. For most of the decade, the country was ravaged by one of the worst economic collapses in modern history that accompanied one of the worst famines in modern history as well, that North Korea's centrally planned system couldn't adequately address. As many as 3.5 million North Koreans would die during this horrific famine throughout the 1990s, as much as 15% of the entire country's population, and all as the government attempted everything it could do to cover up its scale and hide it from the rest of the world. The famine and the crisis within North Korea throughout the 1990s was exacerbated by the first change in leadership in the country's history in 1994, when the Kim dynasty's founder, Kim Il-sung, died after having ruled for the past 45 years and passed on power to his son, Kim Jong-il, establishing the first dynastic succession in North Korea. Kim Jong-il's incompetent mismanagement of the famine greatly exacerbated the scale of the tragedy, and for the next 17 years until his own death, he would continue on advancing his father's cult of personality even further, and rule North Korea with every bit as iron of a fist. To this date, Kim Jong-il, the middle Kim ruler, is still officially regarded by North Korea's legal system to be the country's eternal general secretary, still serving in death alongside of his father, who was similarly designated as the eternal president upon his own death. Kim Jong-il, like his father, is still heralded as nearly a god in the country, along with his own son, who would eventually take the country over himself in the third succession in 2011. And I think that understanding Kim Jong-il and how he continued molding North Korea into the bizarre necro-hereditary dictatorship that it is today is a major lesson in what can happen with truly unchecked power in the modern world. And so, I made an entire new documentary exploring the dark world and life of Kim Jong-il and the most outlandish things that he did while ruling North Korea for decades in my brand new original documentary series that I'm calling Mad Kings, which will take deeper dives into the terrible personal lives and erratic policy decisions of recent megalomaniacal and eccentric dictators. But because of the inherently violent and controversial details surrounding Kim Jong-il, including details and depictions of multiple acts of terrorism that he ordered across the 1980s and 90s, and one of the worst famines in human history, my documentary investigating his reign would never work on YouTube, because it would instantly become demonetized and age-restricted, which means that YouTube's algorithm that's based around showing you ads would never actually be incentivized to show the video to you or to promote it. I deal with very large numbers of my videos on YouTube getting demonetized and age-restricted as they already are, including one of my more recent videos that covered the ongoing events taking place in Darfur. And that's why I'm uploading all of my documentaries in Mad Kings, including this one on Kim Jong-il, exclusively to Nebula instead. And why signing up to Nebula is the absolute best thing that you can do to support me and my channel. And there's never been a better time to sign up, because now you can get 50% off of the annual subscription for just $30 for the entire year. And there's plenty of new content for you to watch right now. There's Scav, a new documentary series by the Jetlag team that follows the world's largest scavenger hunt. There's multiple new exclusive video essays by Lindsay Ellis, and a new short film by Patrick Willems called The Dinner Plan that features Griffin Newman and Zach Cherry. And of course, Nebula is also still home to some of the best curated and informative documentaries available anywhere on the internet today. There's Bobby Broccoli's 17-pages documentary covering one of the largest scientific controversies of the 20th century. Real-time history, 16 Days in Berlin. The most detailed Battle of Berlin documentary ever produced. Whenever Productions, The Logistics of X series, and of course, my own Modern Conflict series. Covering dozens and dozens of modern wars, battles, and conflicts. With plenty more originals from myself and other creators planned throughout 2026. I personally treat Nebula as my own sanctuary away from the noise of algorithmically driven sites like YouTube and other social media. There's no AI bots and no AI-generated slop clogging up your feed here. We choose and vet which creators we work with, and that enables us to only work with the best. Creators who truly love and take pride in what they do. So, if you want to support me and hundreds of other independent creators who still value our craft and get access to some of the best documentaries and video essays anywhere on the internet that you won't find here on YouTube, you can do so by visiting the link that's down below in the description, by scanning the QR code here on your screen, or by clicking the button that's here on your screen and signing up. You'll get 50% off of an annual subscription by doing so, which is just $30 for the whole year or $250 per month. A fraction of the price of YouTube Premium. You can even sign up for a lifetime membership as well with a 40% off discount for $300. If you don't ever want to deal with yet another streaming platform subscription or ads ever again for as long as we both last. I hope that you'll consider signing up or gifting to a friend or a loved one. And as always, thank you so much for watching.